You know. Right. Nick Durst here with Joe Calabrese. And Joe, you're the perfect guest to join us today with everything going on in Major League Baseball with the lockout and, of course, the major news, which is always the New York Mets, the A team around the league these days. But Joe, why don't you let everybody know who we have with us today?
Let's pump the brakes here on the A team stuff. But yes, they did make a tremendous move here at the top of the offseason by signing Max Scherzer, which was a move that nobody saw coming. And yes, currently we are dealing with the lockout. We're going to be dealing with collecting bargaining agreement negotiations coming up here within the next few months. So we have the perfect guest on to do that with us today. He is a longtime baseball columnist for USA Today, and he is somebody who you follow on Twitter. You're a huge baseball fan. You know who he is. So really excited to have him on. Bob Nightingale. Bob, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Nick.
So, Bob, I was telling some people we were going to have you on, and the umpire teacher Twitter account reached out to me, and they wanted me to let you know that they believe that you are the fairest writer there is when it comes to critiquing umpires, and they fully support you and your stance on that. But how do you see things playing out here, I guess, in this CBA? Is there going to be any talk about automatic umpiring or anything in that regard, or that'd be further down the road?
Yeah, right now they haven't even talked about any rule changes at all in the CBA. They got so many other things going on. Right. That's for another day. I don't think the umpires will have a big problem with automated strike zone. They don't believe in it. I don't either. But tell you what, with the way baseball now is embracing gambling, who wants to be responsible if you miss, if you miss a call? And everybody's going to be blamed, like, oh, he did that on purpose. He's on the take. These players on the take. I think it could be a nightmare for everybody involved, particularly umpires. And, we're talking about the automatic strike zone we see on TV. That's not right. It never changes between Aaron Judge and Jose Altuve. So it was cool, the game, the Field of Dreams game, where there was no box and people kind of looked themselves. Hey, was that a strike or not? So we'll see. I'm more optimistic than most of my peers, maybe all my peers on the CBA. I still think they get a deal done around February 1st. I don't think they want to mess around with spring training. I mean, spring training is so popular with fans. If you mess up spring training and fans can't come down to Florida or Phoenix, you're going to alienate those fans maybe forever.
Yeah, those small, the minor league markets, so to say, where the single A teams play are huge, and they always, that's where they get most of their ticket sales for the season. So it's crucial for them to get teams for spring training in their facilities. We'll get to baseball stuff momentarily here, but I wanted to ask you, we know you attended Arizona State University. Obviously, with them, things are kind of on the up with basketball, with Hurley and Herm Edwards for football. Just curious, A, how much do you pay attention to your alma mater sports these days? And B, what ultimately was your driving factor in deciding to attend Arizona State University to study journalism?
Yeah, I don't pay as attention as I used to, maybe because they're not, top teams and, not jumping the bandwagon. I'm shocked that it's not a better program, because it's such a beautiful place to go to school and everything else. Very large, probably too large now, over 80,000 students, but a fun place. And they're producing a lot of journalists. A lot of the baseball writers are from ASU. I'm talking about, guys that just graduated in the last 5 years. So I went to ASU. My dad was Air Force, so we moved around everywhere. But when we were in at the Air Force Academy and in Denver, we'd always go down to Phoenix, or Tempe, I should say, for spring break, and kind of fell in love with the area during those spring breaks. And, it wasn't too far from home, 15-hour drive. So that was a big thing. It was almost like that was always my number one choice, probably just as a kid going down there all the time for in March and February.
So what did you do at Arizona State in terms of internships, being active on campus? Because when I went to school, I wrote for the school newspaper. I did stuff online related to the athletics department. So that's super important here. We've had a lot of previous baseball beat writers on in the past who have kind of worked in and around the area. And Nick and I are from New York City. So what did you do in terms of being active on campus with internships? And ultimately, how did you land something that was, you know, after graduation?
Yeah, I wasn't active like it should have been. Worked for the school newspaper for, you know, two semesters. It was almost more interested in having fun and going to games and that sort of thing, or socializing and hanging around kids. It's almost like, okay, you know, and I didn't really get into the internship program until my senior year. It wasn't really an internship program, which is working part-time at the local sports department, answering telephones and, you know, writing down scores and stats, that side of thing. Almost like a, you know, kind of helping out whoever answers the phone, like a glorified secretary type job. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the whole newspaper vibe. But it's completely different now. I mean, you know, my son went to Bradley University. He was on the, you know, school newspaper and stuff like that, worked for the basketball team and was a Democratic, you know, chairman of the campus. So these days you have to be much more active. When I went to school, it was almost just a more of a social learning experience than anything else. You took all the journalism courses, but kind of just learning to live, you know, life away from home.
So as you're graduating or you just graduated, how many places did you send out some of your clippings or works? And ultimately, how long did it take you before you landed your first job writing?
Well, back then, I remember it was a, so there was no, you know, internet. So you had to, you know, cut and paste stuff to wake up things and send them everywhere. You know, a lot of cool places, you know, like San Diego, Hawaii, that type of Guam, I remember, all over. But I ended up, because the Arizona Republic is located in Phoenix, ended up working there after college. Like I said, almost a answering telephones, doing scores, you know, finally got to, able to cover a high school game. So just worked my way up from there. And then went to Kansas City Star, and then a Los Angeles Times, and then USA Today.
Hey, Bucks fans. Heading to watch Tampa play the New York Jets at MetLife Stadium? Away Game Tailgate is your home away from home. Tailgate with fellow Buccaneers fans before the game. Unlimited food, complimentary beverages, TV with pregame shows, tailgate games, and more. Sign up is easy. Just go to awaygametailgate.com. Away Game Tailgate has set up an exclusive offer for you Know I'm Right listeners. You could find the link to that exclusive offer in the podcast description or head directly to awaygametailgate.com/game/Tampa-Bay-Buccaneers/?ref=6985.
And you've been at USA Today. On your LinkedIn, it says it's in 1998, so it's over 20 years. And we live in a world today where I think it's very difficult for somebody to be at a place for that long. I mean, we think 10 years is a long time. I mean, 20 plus years is a really, really long time. So how did that opportunity come about for you to join USA Today?
Yeah, Lee Ivory and Tim McQuay reached out, and it was working for USA Today and USA Today Sports Weekly, more like to do columns in you know, long features, long form, talking about 100 inches, 120 inch stories, which I enjoyed, and not, you know, not covering a beat, just, you know, jumping on the bandwagon. They had great travel budget, they still do, but it's almost like you jumped on the big stories, and that was very attractive to me, and that's where I've always stayed. They've treated me great. I've always enjoyed the product. I mean, back used to see USA Today's in every hotel room and stuff. It would be cool at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're done with your story, go grab a beer. You're back at your hotel room at 4 and you see your story right there at your hotel doorstep with quotes. Nowadays, the deadlines are so much earlier. You don't see them. You don't hardly see any newspapers in hotels, not even hardly in airports. So times are different. But I always stayed just because I enjoy what my job is. And there was no place I was thinking, man, I wish I could go here. You know, it never happened. I never applied for another job, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, that's great. And I think a lot of people are probably envious of that because it's very rare, as Joe pointed out. How did you ultimately become specialized in Major League Baseball? I know you mentioned doing some other stuff at previous publications, but how did you ultimately become the baseball guy?
I'll credit he's in the Hall of Fame, Tracy Ringlesby. He's out of Denver, lives in Wyoming actually now. Tracy was at the Kansas City Star. And one of the guys is, it was a two-man beat. And he says, hey, why don't you do this with me? I liked all sports. I love the NBA. I love college sports. I love baseball. I like baseball a lot. But I wasn't as familiar with it, say, as the others. And he says, come join me. We'll have a lot of fun. So joined the baseball beat with Tracy. And back then it was a two newspaper operation, a morning paper and afternoon paper. And then Tracy left the Dallas Morning News. I ended up working with Jack Etkin and Dick Cagle. And Dick Cagle also was recently inducted to the, got a Spink Award for writing. So it was really, I'll give credit or give the blame to Tracy for the one getting me into baseball. And then specializing, you start to get accustomed to it. You know, I could switch to different beats and things like that, but then you got to know more, you know, got to learn new people and everything else. And I've always loved the people in baseball, you know, from, you know, the front office, the players, groundskeepers, umpires, everybody. I just think it's a great, great group of people to be around.
How has technology changed your job? Has it made it easier, more difficult at times? Because obviously, when you were first starting off, you know, the internet was around, but it's nothing like it is today.
No, I mean, you know, there was a time where I remember seeing Bob Boone, him and his family had cell phone, you know, those big brick things, never even saw those. You know, back in the day, when you're done with your game story, you're done for the night. You know, it wasn't chasing news. If something broke in the next day's paper, you know, you had all day to work on it. Also, you know, all day to you know, catch up and do that. I mean, remember hearing the stories when Tim Kurkjian, you know, just got elected into the Baseball Writers Wing of the Hall of Fame, you know, getting the three papers in Dallas and kind of squinting every day on his front way driveway. Like, okay, did someone have anything on the front page? Nothing, so it couldn't have been that big. Then you look in the sports section and you're kind of squinting down too. It's almost like your report card. Okay, did I get beat on anything? That sort of thing. So as much now you're on call 24/7, where it was never that way before.
That's a good segue to talk about 24/7 stuff, because I think social media has also altered and changed the way you do your job as well. So would you tell our listeners, in regard to posting on social media or using Twitter, using that as a platform for getting scoops or news stories that you're about to write with, getting that out for yourself as opposed to sitting on information like that and using it in a story or a column, you know, how do you properly teeter that line between your two, and what would your advice be to other people out there who are looking to become a writer or to eventually become a columnist like you?
Well, that's the challenging part. It used to be you sit on a story, and you write it for your newspaper or website, and then after it's published, you know, they can go ahead and tweet it out and stuff. Now it's a thing where, well, who knows what, when there's, you know, somebody hired, when Buck Showalter, you know, who I think will get hired by the Mets, no one's going to sit and write the story, publish it, and then link to it. They're going to tweet it out and then write it. So, you know, the publications such as USA Today, anywhere really, would prefer you have that story ready. And when that announcement comes, tweet it out with your story. So at least you get page views on that story rather than someone just sees a tweet, whoever you work for gets nothing out of that unless you have a story to go with it.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned Buck Showalter, because all this week, everyone's been just tweeting about that story. We're recording this on December 9th. So as of now, the Mets still doing their interviews. By the time this comes out, perhaps they would have hired Buck Showalter, but Bob, it seems like he's the front runner. Some of the reports are saying, maybe you heard the same thing, that that's who Cohen wants. So I got a kind of question. If that's who he wanted, how come Cohen didn't even meet with Buckshalter? It seems like just Epler met with him. And ultimately, is Epler really having a say in this? If Cohen wants his guy, isn't that who he's going to get?
Well, there's going to be two rounds of interviews with that. And so, you know, hey, Steve Cohen hired Billy Epler to make these decisions. It's supposed to be Epler's final call. That being said, when Billy Epler was GM of the Angels, he was forced to hire, forced to fire Brad Ausmus, and I want to fire Ausmus. Right. They did a round of interviews. He wanted Buck Showalter to be the manager. The owner, Artie Marino, says, no, we're going to hire Joe Maddon. When Epler was up for this job, you know, I knew right away, or thought right away, I don't know, but thought right away, it's got to be Showalter for that reason. You know, Showalter can handle New York, everything else. But yeah, if Steve Cohen, I mean, he's a natural guy for Steve Cohen to want Showalter, makes all the sense in the world. If he wanted a first-year manager, it would look awfully funny. So, I mean, to me, of all the guys being interviewed, and to not interview Bruce Bochy for this job, it was really just, you know, two guys. You're going to hire, you're going to hire him, Buck Showalter, or are you going to hire Brad Ausmus, the two guys with experience? You're not going to hire a first-year manager, Joe Espada or somebody else, for a team in New York. It's not a small market team. You know, you got Max Scherzer that kind of money to win right now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Cohen, he doesn't want anybody learning on his dollars. So those learn somewhere else. But you know, I'm wondering now, because he's not even up for this job at this point, but do you think within the next 3 years or so that Carlos Beltran finally gets a shot at managing, because everybody else in the scandal is managing?
He should. I'd love to see him. I thought it was wrong that he got fired for that. He was a player. He wasn't the manager. He was, you know, wasn't the bench coach. So many guys knew about this. And yeah, I mean, here's Cora, you know, prospering again. You know, certainly AJ Hinch in Detroit, both got manager year votes. So no, I thought it was unfair that he was forced to resign in the first place. I really did.
Yeah, definitely not good, not a good look there. And you know, I wonder if with the Mets, since we're talking about them and the hot topic, if thinking back now, if Cohen would have think in hindsight is saying, maybe I should have just held on to Van Wagon for another year, because the last year was just horrible with the front office and all the questions that came out of it. So maybe there would have been more stability there. And, you know, obviously there were some issues in the clubhouse, of course, with Lindor not getting along with players, but he's going to be here for the long term. Now, of course, Scherzer, he's being brought in. He's got that intensity. He's probably going to be the locker room leader. But how much of a divide really is there between position players and pitchers? And is it difficult at all to get the position players to, you know, go to our pitcher as their leader?
No, that's always been a problem, just because it's not an everyday player. But I will say with Max Scherzer, this going back to his Detroit days, he was always kind of considered an everyday guy. He was a guy running clubhouse pools. He was joking with the guys. So when other pitchers would act like, hey, I'm a pitcher, he would always act as, you know, one of the position players. So I think it's going to be an easy transition for him, makeup and stuff like that. It's almost like, hey, Greg Maddux is a pitcher, but nobody's doing the clubhouse pools and that kind of stuff. But Scherzer will jump on guys and things like that. So in most cases, you're actually, you know, absolutely right, Nick, where it's tough for a pitcher, particularly a starting pitcher. But in this case, no. I mean, Adam Wainwright has done the same thing in St. Louis. John Lester did the same thing. And so John Lackey in Chicago. But it's difficult to pull off.
So, you know, right now, Epler, he's basically saying, oh, we're pretty much set offensively. I think looking into the team, they really haven't improved much offensively. I mean, obviously they got Marte, you know, Conforto had a down year, but maybe there's not too much of a change there. I think despite what they're saying, I think they're still probably very much in on Chris Bryant. What have you been hearing about the Mets and Chris Bryant?
Yeah, the talking Bryant has been quiet to me before the, you know, lockout. He kind of raised the red flag. Why isn't San Francisco being aggressive on Bryant? They just had him. You know, you hear talk about Seattle, which make a lot of sense. I'm not sure about Colorado. I know it's close to home, but they're, you know, ways away from contending. No, I would think Chris Bryant would be a perfect type of fit. Remember, Conforto is a free agent too, so we'll see. But I haven't heard talks with you know, that yet. But obviously, Boris now has a relationship with Steve Cohen and stuff with the Max Scherzer contract. So, you know, so why not?
Certainly. And, you know, the Mets, they're saying, oh, we got it. We're targeting starting pitching. I mean, there is some good pitchers out there. Rodon, if you want to go on a short-term deal, Greinke's out there. So you're going to do something. But the Mets, I think they need to really kind of focus on their bullpen, because Edwin Diaz has been okay as a Met, but he definitely held them. He was the reason why they didn't make the postseason in 2019. So be interesting to see if they attack the bullpen market. But it seems like there really hasn't, or before the lockout, there really wasn't much of a market. Nobody was signing many big time deals for the relievers, Bob.
No, there hasn't. You know, I'd be curious to see if they go after a guy like Kenley Jansen. I mean, do like the Yankees, where you have two closers in the back end, that sort of thing. You know, losing Aaron Loop, that was a big loss. I mean, he was very good. Jansen, I think would be a great fit. And, you know, we'll see if he comes back to the Dodgers or not. But he almost went to Washington Nationals when he was a free agent last time. I would think, you know, and he's a guy, too, would be, I think, could handle New York and everything else.
Believe it or not, we do touch on the Yankees at times on this show, too. It's not just all about the Mets. So speaking of players who are still out there, the Yankees missed, I think, a golden opportunity for Corey Seager. Now, it's going to cost a lot of money, but we've been hearing shortstops. Do they need to upgrade on Gleyber Torres? Are they going to slide Gio Urshela over and make him the full everyday shortstop? Most people think that they're going to go out and they're going to get a shortstop. Carlos Correa is a name that's been thrown out there. Trevor Story is a name that's been thrown out there a lot. What do you see in regard to the Yankees' activity, possibly bringing in a big-time shortstop? And if there are the other names that have been linked to the Yankees, you know, if you can give us that, that'd be great.
You know, back in, I was in New York for the you know, anniversary of 9/11, and asked the Yankee people then about the shortstop market. And they insisted they weren't going to be a big player in the big shortstops. Kind of, they're in love with their prospects, you know, particularly with Volpe. They insist that he's going to be a superstar. So he's still a good 2 years away. If Trevor Story wants to take a short-term deal, that would make sense. They can always bring back Didi Gregorius or someone else. I think they'll get a shortstop, but I don't think it's going to be a Correa, and I'm not sure about Story, unless he takes a short-term deal. You know, I think a Marcus Semien would have been perfect fit, but certainly weren't going to go 7 years, else they would have done the same thing with Correa. So I think they'll go cheap in the shortstop market, I do.
Maybe Andrelton Simmons seems like a good fit there.
Yeah, bad option.
Good defense. What are you hearing as far as the Oakland A's, but a manager, is it a safe assumption that it would probably be a first-time manager taking that job?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be, you know, definitely a first-time manager. And I would think, I'm trying to think of Mark Kotze. I think Mark Kotze would have the inside track there. You know, I don't rule out some of the other young guys, but I think they're going to keep stripping that payroll down. I think they're going to trade a Matt Olson, a Matt Chapman. I think they could get down to a $45, $50 million payroll. So I know people don't talk about Ron Washington, but, you know, who wants to go there to lose for several years? So, yeah, I think Kotze's got the inside track.
So with both the Mets and the A's, how challenging is it going to be once they get a manager to put a coaching staff in place? Maybe less so with the A's because they might keep a lot of the guys. The Mets have one person on the staff, the pitching coach, Jeremy Hefner. So that's kind of an arranged marriage, him with whoever the manager is. But you know, they can't be poaching talent from other organizations in December. So, you know, where are they looking here? Because everybody that they would have to sign to be their coaches probably has to be not in the game at this point.
Yeah. Now, if you're a Buck Showalter, you know so many people, and a lot of his coaches happen to be, you know, unemployed. Brian Butterfield, you know, got let go by the Angels. Wayne Kirby left the San Diego Padres. You know, there's guys around that, you know, should have major league jobs and don't. So I think a guy with Showalter and his experience, if he does get the job, I think it'll be easier for him to recruit and grab guys. I know a few people took jobs this winter, not knowing whether Showalter would be back in the game, but they couldn't afford to wait.
Right. So Showalter is probably your imagination or your mind. He's already calling these people probably, right? Saying, if I get the job, be ready to go.
Absolutely. And even though it's a lockout, you're still allowed to hire a manager and coaches and things like that. And I think, you know, Showalter's had those conversations even before the, you know, Mets job even opened up. If I get a job in San Diego, if I get a job, you know, X place, will you come with me? So, yeah, I think those conversations took place in the last year.
So as you've previously reported, I think both sides are still far apart in terms of negotiations, and the scheduling for that remains kind of up in the air. What I wanted to ask you off the top of your head in particular, which organizations out there do you think are affected the most by the uncertainty right now in the negotiations between both sides?
Well, I mean, I think the teams that need to do stuff, you know, like the Yankees are very affected. You know, the Oakland A's, we just talked about needing to trade people, that sort of thing. I think those are affected. But as far as the economic part, I go to the teams that need to sell tickets to make money. So I'm looking at a team like the Milwaukee Brewers, who rely big time on ticket sales because their fan base is low. A team like St. Louis, same thing, draws over 40,000 fans a game. You know, the Dodgers, I mean, with their TV rights, they don't need to sell a season ticket. You also feel bad for a team like Atlanta. I mean, they just won the World Series. Normally you'd have a big, you know, push off that or be wanting season tickets for next year. But with this uncertainty and Atlanta not being able to do something, you know, you're kind of a standstill. I mean, you feel bad for the Mets making all their moves. It's like you should be able to build on that and sell tickets. And right now, you know, everybody's kind of waiting to see, hey, is there going to be a season? When does it start? You know, that sort of thing.
Do you think any teams are going to go into fire sale mode too as well? Because I've heard a team like the Reds, who kind of went for it this year, fell short, weren't bad, but probably don't see themselves as playoff contenders in that division over the course of the next couple of years. So they're a team that could possibly sell. Have you heard about any other teams like that?
No, I mean, you know, Oakland A's, we talked about, but you're right about the Reds. I mean, they've let teams know, hey, you give us the right price. Sonny Gray is gone. He's got 1 year left in the contract. He's gone. I was surprised they didn't, you know, hold on to Wayne Miley and trade him. But, you know, the only team that made a claim on him was the Chicago Cubs. Castillo, everybody wants. So, Moustakas, I think, is there for the taking. Someone takes a contract, he's gone. So, yeah, I think those two teams stand out the most, you know, top of my head as far as teams that are willing to dump.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. And I hope you're right, February 1st, because I think if it goes anywhere past that, I think the start of the season is probably going to be pushed back, I would think, because, you know, what we saw last year, we need those 3 weeks to get ready for spring training. Kind of just with the timeline, if they go up to March, I mean, then you still have all these free agents. So yeah, it would be very difficult or challenging to see that happening. And also for you, I mean, right around this time, usually every year, not 2 years in a row, no winter meetings. So how has that been for you? Usually you're used to probably going around, making a lot of connections and coming up with a lot of story ideas.
Yeah, the winter meetings aren't like they used to be. It used to be a great place to be. You would see every single GM, you know, down by the bar at night, talking shop, scouts, that sort of thing. You know, the managers are still all there. That part hasn't changed. But that being said, now that GM meetings has kind of replaced that, the GM meetings, you know, already took place in La Casa, California. You know, there's probably about 100 reporters there, but the access is so much better at the GM meetings now, where people don't miss the winter meetings at all, but they don't want to miss the GM meetings.
Absolutely. And curious to hear, when you're going to the ballpark for games, what is your routine? You know, what time are you usually getting there? What are you doing first? And is there any you know, are you going and saying, all right, let me eat a pregame meal here, or are you snacking throughout the game? What's your whole process like with a day at the ballpark?
Yeah, well, I'll go pre-COVID, you know, when things were normal. Yeah. Say the clubhouse opens at 3:30, you get ballpark by 2:45, 3, just kind of, you know, set up your computer and everything else, get ready. And as soon as those clubhouses are open, you would go into the one, whether it's the visiting side or home side, and grab who you need, or at least set up something, say, hey, can I grab you after batting practice? And you, so the home clubhouse always closes first, and then the visiting stays open a good hour afterwards because they take batting practice last. So then you go to the visiting side. Then you, you know, you're talking to the managers, players. Then when you're done, if you get time, you know, jump over to the umpire's room just to say hello and see who's there, just for a few minutes. Go upstairs to the press box and see what scouts are up there, you know, about to go eat or just watching the game. And usually the best is to have your dinner, you know, with the scouts and just talk shop, you know, until the game starts.
Last question from me here, and then we're going to let you go. You've got to cover a lot of memorable games through the years. Which ones stand out in your mind the most? And if there's a favorite one, we would like to hear that one as well.
Yeah, and I'm going back. It's my first postseason. The ones that stand out the most still is 86 Mets, the game six. I mean, it's a, I think there was a rain delay during it. But anyways, a long day. And I mean, two outs, nobody on. Everybody's running the story how the Red Sox have exercised the ghosts, everything like that. And literally, people had their head down in their computers. And when the rally is going, people aren't paying attention until the tying run scores. And, you know, I heard some guys say, oh my God, what's going on here? And then, of course, you know, the Mets win that game, then the rain out, and of course, the day after. Then the other one, of course, is the, you know, the infamous, you know, David Henderson game when he hit the home run off Donnie Moore. You know, we know what happened there. But just that postseason, 86 was incredible. You know, then I'd probably jump over to the David Freese game with St. Louis. Same type of thing. I mean, they were dead in that game. You know, Texas was up two or three times. All you need is one more strike.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Freese took over. So those are the those games jump out to me the most, particularly when a team looks like they're done. Their season's over, and then come back and win. Like nobody hardly remembers game seven of the 86 series or even game seven of the Cardinals Texas, but they all remember those game sixes.
Were you, did you cover the 2004 ALCS?
No, I did the ALCS that year. Yeah. So yeah, I remember watching the, you're talking about the Cubs.
Sorry about the run, the Red Sox beat the Yankees that came back. Down.
Yeah, no, I was there. I was there. But I will say about those games, I mean, those were great at Fenway, you know, long games. And they, and then they, when they came back, went those two last two games in New York were terrible games. I mean, they were both blowout. Right.
But yeah. I mean, people those, remember it for the bloody sock.
Right, right. Right. It was just almost like, okay, I mean, those games, you know, David Ortiz with the home runs, and of course, the, you know, getting the winning hit off Mariano. And speaking of that, I forgot another game that will stand out. It was the might be my favorite game seven was the Yankees and Arizona Diamondbacks.
Oh,
yeah. And Diamondbacks have been an expansion franchise. And they probably should have swept that World Series. They kept blowing the games with their closer in New York. And then to come back against Mariano and Luis Gonzalez gets that hit. You know, that's happy top five, too.
Yeah, and they kind of had to sneak that all in there at the end, but it's all right. Bob, thank you for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun, a lot of great insights. Hope you come on again in the future. And what we do here is we give our guests the last word. So if there's anything else you would like to share, if there's anything else you would like to promote, go ahead. The floor is all yours. Thanks again for doing this with us.
No, thanks, Joe. Thanks, Nick. Yeah, thanks for doing this. And yeah, keep it going. It's fun to see there's such an infusion of young talent in the business. Talking about guys, you know, out of college. And, you know, going right to, you know, covering baseball and things like that with a lot of great ideas, you know, whether it's analytics or something like that, just different approaches. So I thought baseball writers in general did a great job during the pandemic when nothing was going on at all. They were kind of coming up with some creative ideas, which was fun to see. It's fun to see, you know, you two guys doing this. So thank you so much.
We appreciate it, Bob. Thank you for the kind words. That's going to do it here for this episode of You Know I'm Right. For our very special guest, Bob Nightingale, and for my co-host, Joe Calabrese, I'm Nick Durst, and this has been You Know I'm Right.